Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. Just some housekeeping items as you usually do at the beginning of each show. We got an outstanding response from our episode on Esteban Carpio out of Providence, Rhode Island. Man, what a case that was. There was a lot of information I didn't know about that case. I knew about Esteban Carpio being brought into the courtroom after being roughed up by police, because that's seemingly what the news wanted you to see. What I didn't know about Esteban Carpio, the murderer of Jimmy Allen, I didn't remember that he had been picked up for stabbing an 84-year-old woman, and I most certainly didn't know that in a five-year period from the year 2000 to the year 2005, Carpio had been arrested 15 times. Some were crimes of violence, some were felonies. But you can't tell me, guys, that a judge doesn't look at this and say, geez, on the 11th arrest in just a few years, you don't look at this and say, man, this guy just isn't getting it. Probation, parole isn't working for this guy. He's not a candidate for probation. He's too violent. He's too reckless, and he's on too many drugs. That was Esteban Carpio's real problem here. And no judge, they don't see it as their responsibility to say, listen, if I let you out here, you're going to hurt somebody. The trajectory of your crimes, of your life, of how you're making a living is going to get somebody hurt. And it did. Imagine this kid. He's out driving around after having dropped his girlfriend off for an interview to become an escort, right? While she's doing that, you're looking for old ladies to rob. And he sees one hanging out outside of her own home. And he says, yeah, geez, I'm going to park the car around the corner, go up and steal her purse. When she didn't give up the purse willingly, he stabbed her right in the back. I certainly didn't know about that at the time, man. And then what happened to Jimmy Allen in that conference room at the Providence police station? This kid wouldn't have served 5 years. I think in the episode I said he wouldn't have served more than 3 years. I just don't think he would have. And a five-year beef, he wouldn't have served 3 years of that, guys. You know how it is up here. And now he's serving life right where he belongs. The only real upside to this case is Esteban Carpio is still in maximum security prison. Obviously, can't get the violence out of his life even in prison. I just can't imagine seeing an 84-year-old woman, right? And your character inside your soul says, I'm going to rob her, right? And then when she doesn't give it up, I'm going to stab her. That's Esteban Carpio, guys. Also, guys, that Esteban Carpio episode came by way of listener suggestion. Neil C. actually had suggested that most recently in a couple other ones. Today, we're going to cover another Rhode Island case out of Warwick, Rhode Island. And man, is it horrendous. It literally changed the law in Rhode Island for juveniles. You probably know where I'm going with this one, but this is the case of Craig Price out of Warwick, Rhode Island. Man, this is a bloody case, and I have to give you a warning right now. This case is going to involve supreme violence against women and children, so you have to be cognizant of that fact. This guy, Craig Price, at the time was just a teenager, but let me tell you the full story. We'll go through the whole shebang. We do have to jump back into the Wayback Machine, guys, so grab your hats. We're heading back to the 1980s in Warwick, Rhode Island. Let me tell you a little bit about Warwick, Rhode Island, from what I know about it. Warwick is a small city in Rhode Island. When you fly into Providence Airport, you're actually flying into Warwick, Rhode Island. A lot of people don't know that. They make jokes about it at the airport and stuff like that. But Warwick houses the airport there. It's a beautiful community. It's a beachfront. They have several beaches away from the airport, unlike Logan Airport, where if you're at the beach in Boston, the planes are coming in hot and heavy. But Warwick is a gorgeous town. They have a vibrant downtown. It's completely gorgeous, and it's probably about a 20-minute commute to Providence, I guess, and probably about an hour to Boston. Parts of Warwick, Rhode Island remind me of a town in Massachusetts, Hingham, Massachusetts. It's kind of upscale. The downtown's vibrant, just like Hingham. They seemingly have good schools as far as public schools go these days. It's really kind of an all-American city. I didn't even really know it was a city. I assumed it was a town, but my research reveals it's a city town government style, right? So Craig Price lived in a neighborhood called Buttonwood or Button Woods, and it's a beautiful little area. Seemingly, it's a collection of ranch-style homes, Cape-style homes, kind of on the smaller side. There are newer areas of Warwick where there are big colonials and stuff, but Inez Avenue, where Craig lived, was a beautiful little community with ranch-style homes, well-manicured lawns, typical suburbia, really. So when these cases I'm going to tell you about hit the news and Craig Price was named as a suspect, people were like gobsmacked that he seemingly was a great kid around town. He was a big kid. He had a growth spurt, you know, just before the age of 13. So he was over 200 pounds. He was just a big kid. But not in like a bullying way. He would use his size to help his neighbors. He'd help shovel. He was involved in the community, had great friends right in his own neighborhood. They'd play in the street, hockey, basketball, whatever it was, whatever the season may be, if you remember how it was in the 80s. And Craig Price was a part of that. And he was kind of like the neighborhood comedian, very funny, very engaging. He'd engage with adults, kids, it didn't matter. He seemed like a happy-go-lucky kid, and that was also his reputation at school. Not really a class clown in school, but funny enough, engaging, teachers liked him, students liked him. You would think nothing was wrong. His parents were homeowners in the neighborhood. His dad worked as a manager for the Pepsi company, which I believe has a big bottling plant down there, and his mother worked at Kmart. I think dad would later work at Kmart as well. But most people don't really remember Kmart. But in the 80s, it was kind of a retail force. So it seems like Craig had the usual 1970s, 80s upbringing. Mom worked, dad worked, and kids played outside and they go to school. And that was life. And seemingly it was good. You know, it was kind of the American dream, right? Buy your own home, go to work, raise your kids. So the Price family was African-American, and I think in the Buttonwood area, they were probably one of the only African-American families. I'm sure that wasn't easy, but quite frankly, it didn't seem to be a large problem in the Price's life. You know, it just didn't. So just an aside as to the information I've come up with in my research. Like I said, Craig appeared on the outside to be a really great kid, but I picked up some reports of him having been arrested prior to age 13 for some pretty serious crimes. Burglary is probably the top of them. He was stalking a woman or a girl, and I think these were separate instances. He had multiple entries, I believe, on his criminal record for breaking into people's houses. And the stalking thing, a little crazy, quite frankly, at that age. So he would have had to been, what, under 12 or 13 at that time. for somebody to do that at that age indicates to me some mental problems, you know? So it's kind of a dichotomy here on Craig Price. He's been pinched several times under the age of 12. On the other hand, people say he's a good and gregarious kid. I think it would turn out that the good and gregarious Craig Price was just a mask. From the age of about 9 years old on, Craig seemed to be in some type of spiral. He was doing some pretty hard drugs, you know, from that time. At least before the age of 13, he was doing LSD, marijuana. I'm sure alcohol goes along with that. And I say, seemingly everybody loved him in the neighborhood, but I think he'd do those B&Es right in the neighborhood too. So again, it's a crazy dichotomy with this kid. People seemingly loved him because he was so interactive with people. And then he was very angry. He was a very angry kid. But sometimes that happens as you approach adolescence, and most of us outgrow it, right? Craig wouldn't, and would get worse. All right, guys, so that brings us up to July 27th, 1987. Craig Price was 14 years old, and he was seemingly out of control. As I look at it now, it seems as though, although there were two parents in the household, they didn't have much control over Craig. He was about 6 feet tall and over 200 pounds at this point. Just a behemoth of a kid. Never mind a man. He has a man-sized body at this point. And he was openly smoking marijuana and other things. It's, again, a dichotomy. He seems like an ass at home and committing crimes in the neighborhood, but everybody liked the kid. So, July 27th, 1987, he sees a woman lying on her side, watching TV, two houses away from where he lived. Craig lived at 60 Inez Avenue, and just two houses away lived Rebecca Spencer. And she was in the process of moving. There were boxes everywhere. She was, I believe, newly divorced, and she was in the process of moving out of that house. It is my assumption, and only my assumption at this point, that that was the Spencers' marital home. She had some little ones in the house with her. It must have been a decent-type divorce with not a lot of emotion, because the ex-husband took the kids so Rebecca could clear out the house to move. So there were boxes everywhere. Rebecca, I believe, had people in and out of the house all day helping her pack up, and she was about ready to get out. The boxes were packed. At nighttime, she put on some pajamas and laid down to watch some videos on MTV or VH1, I think it was, actually. So remember, this is 87, so she falls asleep on the floor. Craig Price had crept through the backyard. This would be a pattern for him going forward. And he had watched her, much like he had stalked another woman previously. And I believe he had gotten into trouble with that affair. And I don't even think the crime of stalking was on the books at that point. But it's now 1987. Craig is 14 years old. And he's looking into the window, and he sees Rebecca Spencer lying on her side. And he decides to break in and kill her and steal whatever he could. So he does just that. He breaks in, but I think the door was open. And this is 1987 in Warwick, Rhode Island. I'm sure the doors were open, right? Because it's a safe neighborhood, a supremely safe neighborhood. But Rebecca is lying in front of the TV on the floor. And as Craig Price walks up to her, he grabs a frying pan and he's going to use that as a weapon. But as he gets closer, he sees a table with these boxes on it, the moving boxes, and there's like a 10-inch knife there. And he puts down the frying pan, grabs the knife. During Craig's confession, which would come a few years later, he said he stood over Rebecca for several minutes, and some type of anger built in him, And he ended up taking this 10-inch knife and stabbing her, guys, 58 times. Neck, torso, face. He brutalized this woman. And, man, it was just savage. It was an absolute and utter bloodbath. So Craig does this dastardly deed, and he skulks off back into the yard to get away. And before he goes over the fence, he remembers that he had touched the frying pan on the counter. He goes back in and retrieves the frying pan, takes it with him, and somewhere between the yards, he only lived two houses away, he disposes of the frying pan, which would have had his fingerprints on it, right? And the next day, this homicide is discovered, and man, it sent that Buttonwood neighborhood into a tailspin. And most of the other sections of Rhode Island as well, and definitely all of Warwick. So the whole city was rocked by this homicide of Rebecca Spencer. It didn't come out till later, the horrific nature of it. He stabbed almost 60 times, guys. She was brutalized. So I'd have to assume that pretty quickly, Rebecca Spencer's ex-husband, or soon-to-be ex-husband, they describe him as the ex-husband, so I think they were divorced. But I think he would have been the focus of this, but he had the kids, and he was probably home with them wherever he was living, right? So I think they would have gotten through the ex-husband as a suspect pretty quickly, but then they had nothing. It's 1987, and it doesn't seem that long ago, but in terms of crime scene analysis, there was fingerprints and there was blood typing. There was no DNA. I mean, if they ever found that frying pan, they would have tied it back to the neighbor. And it's hard to fault the cops for not looking at, you know, 13-year-old neighbor kids, no matter how big they are, because this is an adult type crime. Nobody would ever think some 13-year-old kid's going to go in the back door with a 10-inch knife and stab his neighbor for no reason. These homicides that really have no motive, like stranger-on-stranger crimes, are very difficult to prove, you know, because there's no rhyme or reason to them. Most murders, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, are pretty easy to solve. It's typically the person you were in a relationship with. There's always motivation, you know, there's love, hate, lust, greed, revenge. And just going through the victimology, you can see who'd want revenge, why are you divorced, those type of things. That's what happens with victimology. Rebecca was divorced, but that was the end of that, really. She didn't have a lot of bad things in her life. And once I think they cleared the ex-husband, they were left with mostly nothing here. From what I read, guys, the murder of Rebecca Spencer, it shocked the police. I mean, it's Warwick and it's close enough to Providence, the big city and all that, but holy cow. So they thought somebody in Rebecca's life was extremely angry with her, because you just don't think of stranger on stranger crime immediately. But I believe the Warwick police and the State Police, Rhode Island State Police, had some false starts in this case, and they were running down leads on it, but we know they didn't lead to Craig Price. So life seemingly goes on in the Buttonwood section of Warwick, Rhode Island, and Craig Price goes on to school. He'd find himself 2 years later as a freshman at Warwick High, and he certainly hadn't turned himself around. And he had already committed one brutal homicide, and he had thought he had gotten away with it. And if this didn't go any further, I believe Craig Price would have gotten away with that permanently. So in the intervening 2 years from 87 to 1989, Craig Price's spiral continued. He continued to have problems, not really problems with people in the neighborhood, but like these petty crimes, you know what I mean? And I probably shouldn't characterize burglary as a petty crime, because look what happened in Rebecca Spencer's burglary, right? juvenile records are sealed, so nobody really knew the extent of Craig Price's problem, although some of his friends did. But I think they attributed that to Craig's big mouth. He was always trying to make people laugh, had these fanciful stories, and I think that's what they put on his bravado. So now it seems Craig is in high school. I'm sure the football team was looking for him to try out. He was a huge kid at this point, just kept on getting bigger and bigger. I don't think his dad was that big. I don't know if it ran in the family or what, but when you see photos of this kid, he looks like a college student, right? Baby-faced, but man's body, right? He goes on to life, but things would go off the rails again. That takes us up to September 1st, 1989. So police believe sometime during the nighttime hours of September 1st, 1989, Joan Heaton, age 39, was home with her daughters, Jennifer, 10, and Melissa, 7. I don't know what the Heaton's marital situation was like, but I do believe that Carl Heaton, Joanne Heaton's brother, lived there or was there frequently, and he was a nighttime security guard at some local facility. And they all lived there together in the Inez Avenue area along with Craig Price, right? And 2 years prior that murder happens, I'm sure it scared the hell out of them. But sometime on the night of September 1st, 1989, and this one's difficult, I have to say. Craig Price is skulking around the backyards of his neighborhood, much like he had when he had murdered Rebecca Spencer. So he's skulking around, and he decides he's going to break in. And during a later confession, he says that this break-in was going to happen so he could steal, only steal. I don't believe that, but what happens next is absolutely horrific. He breaks into the Heaton's home on Inez Avenue, and as he's doing so, he makes some type of noise, and he wakes up mom, Joanne Heaton, who is age 39, and she screams, and he decides he's going to beat her and strangle her. And as this happens, there's a lot of commotion, which wakes up the kids, Jennifer, age 10, and Melissa, age 7. They come downstairs to see their mother being slaughtered, literally slaughtered by Craig Price. They scream, run about, and they're basically begging Craig Price to stop. At a certain point, he stabs Joanne Heaton 57 times, and the kids are going apeshit, obviously. Then he turns his rage. He says he goes into this blind rage where he sees red and all this BS. But he turns his rage on to Jennifer first, age 10. And he goes on to stab her, guys, 62 times. 62 times. This guy, who probably weighs over 250 pounds at this point, is stabbing a 10-year-old girl 62 times. They're screaming and begging for their lives, begging him. You know what his answer was? No. He goes on to stab Melissa more than 30 times. At a certain point, he gets up from this little girl's body and picks up a stool in the kitchen and beats her in the head with it. He beats her so bad, guys, there's an open fracture on her skull, and the detectives have to deal with that. Imagine that. It was an orgy of murder that this guy did to these people who did nothing, and I mean nothing to him. Can you imagine that? This is like a Ted Bundy murder. It would come out later, and Craig Price would admit to it that he bit the mother, Joanne Heaton, and he bit the daughter, age 10. So not only does he savage him with a knife, he bites them like an animal. And I don't want to say he's an animal because animals don't work like this. Only humans do. Animals kill each other for food. Craig Price kills for fun. So Craig collects as many of the weapons he used and kind of skulks out of there. It is one of the bloodiest crime scenes in Rhode Island history. These people, Joanne Heaton, Jennifer Heaton, and Melissa Heaton, were slaughtered in their home. Their only crime was living next to Craig Price. Imagine that. Loved ones don't hear from the Heatons for a while, and they start to get nervous. Family goes over there and discovers this crime scene. They're smart enough to back out and call the cops. The cops are totally overwhelmed at this point. You know, 2 years prior, there was that other murder of Rebecca Spencer, and they know this is tied because it's a frenzy, and so was the other one. Pretty quickly, the Warwick Police and the Rhode Island State Police go into the FBI, and they have one of the profilers, and I forget his name, I'm sorry, one of the famous profilers do a profile on this homicide, these two homicides, actually, because the Warwick detectives came to the conclusion that, yeah, this is a serial killer here. So the FBI says, yes, it's a disorganized rage killer, and they believe he was very young. Part of the profile said this was such a frenzy, it's extremely likely that the perpetrator cut himself in the hand or another body part during this frenzy. And if we had DNA at that time, I think that would have been confirmed on the scene. But we didn't. But the profiler was so accurate on this. In the neighborhood, in the Buttonwood neighborhood, just in the days after, the cops are going through and they know Craig Price. They know him both from his mask of being a good kid and the reality of him doing B&Es in the neighborhood. And they see him. And they talk to him about the murders. Hey, what have you heard? He knows everybody in the neighborhood, so he would be a good source. So these patrolmen, these aren't even detectives. These are just regular cops doing good work. They talk to Craig Price and his friends, and they notice he's got a bandage on his hand. They say, hey, Craig, what happened to you? So Craig gives some cockamamie story about punching a car window. I don't know if he says he was trying to break into it, a fit of rage, some BS, right? But the cops don't really buy it, but they play it off like they do. The cops don't go to the superiors right away because there's really not much to go to them with. So they go through their own process where they search criminal records, criminal reports, to see if there was any vandalism done to a car in the Buttonwood area, in the greater area, and there isn't, because that's something someone would file a police report on, right? Vandalism for the insurance and all that. So they come up with nothing, and it just seems like Craig is selling some BS. That's when they go to their superiors. The superiors, they laud these cops. Those two cops, and I don't have their names, otherwise I'd give them to you, solve this case, those two cops in the neighborhood. So Craig seemingly fits that profile, disorganized teenage killer who injured himself. And don't forget, he lives on Inez Avenue, and that's where Rebecca was stabbed as well. So now they're thinking, geez, this kid, right? They ask him to take a lie detector, and he refuses. The cops seemingly go about their business, but they go get a search warrant. So when the police officers, the patrolmen, start their little investigation in the neighborhood, that was around September 5th from what I can gather. September 17th, 1989, they get the search warrant for all buildings and the usual search warrant language. They go to do the search warrant in the early morning hours. There's a significant police presence and Craig's home is searched. When Craig finds out what the police are there to do, he literally goes back to bed. One of the cops goes back in his bedroom, and he is sound asleep. Sound asleep. They seemingly don't find anything of evidentiary value in the house itself. but there's a shed on the property, and the warrant includes all outbuildings as well. So when they go in there, guys, they come across a crap ton of evidence. In the back of the shed, in a plastic bag, there were several bloody knives and other items. Some of the items, I believe, were taken from the victims' homes. And the largest item of evidentiary value was something from the Heaton home where this crazy triple murder took place. And it was a sock, a bloody sock, size 13, Craig's size. The FBI profiler said, yeah, that lends to his disorganization, and he knew this before the search warrant was conducted. So to find that sock, there were sock prints, bloody sock prints all around the house. He must have lost his sneaker while he is doing this crazy homicide. And I'm telling you what happened, what he did with the stool, the knives, the multiple stab wounds, and I still think you're not giving this the full credit for the bloody gore that Craig Price conducted on this family. But the blood will match others in the Heaton household, and it's definitely Craig's, right? And if we had DNA back then, I think the DNA would have all matched up, and all the lights would have went off like a slot machine. So they find all that evidence in the shed, and that's just enough to lock Craig up for homicide, and they do so. And all the while, this guy's blood pressure doesn't go up a blip. His mother is an inconsolable mess. Meanwhile, Craig, there's nothing from him, no emotion. They get him down to the station, and pretty quickly, he confesses. I'm going to put a clip of his confession in the show notes, and I want you to brace yourselves because this guy's just an animal. He's evil. There's evil in this world, and Craig Price is among those evil people. Reminds me of a scene in Midnight Express where the American was arrested for attempting to smuggle drugs in Turkey, and he's in a Turkish prison. One of the other inmates says, "We're all just bad machines." Craig Price was a bad machine, I think, from Jump Street. So as the confession goes, and he's 15 at the time, he knows at this time, 1989, if a juvenile commits a homicide at age 18, he goes free. That was the law then. Can you believe it? Craig Price would later change that, but he thought he was going to do a few years and they couldn't put him in big boy jail. Something called the training school. It was basically a juvenile prison, and it was a joke, quite frankly. So seemingly everything was now sewn up, right? They've got this confession for four homicides, and the case is seemingly locked up. But again, everybody starts to panic because at Craig's 18th birthday, he can no longer be held for crimes that he committed as a juvenile. And he was arrested just days before, I believe, his 16th birthday. It's just crazy. So theoretically, he would have served 2 years in juvenile prison and then be released. That was the law. And during Craig's time in juvenile prison, he bragged about what he did. He also bragged about what he was going to do when he got out. Seemingly, it was more homicide, but man. It's crazy. So the state of Rhode Island was in complete shock. When I tell you this is wall-to-wall coverage, think O.J. Simpson on a local level because you got a couple different factors. Just this kid's age, right? From 13 to 15, he commits four murders and he confesses to them. You know, there's no question of guilt here. The only question was motive. And the motive this guy gives is just whacked. So I know I had mentioned the Price family was one of only a few African-American families in the area. So all the people he killed were white. And basically he stated that he hated white people due to the racism that he had suffered. And in one instance, Carl Heaton, supposedly had stated some racial stuff to Craig and his friends using the N-word. I think about playing hockey in the street or something in the street where Craig was with his friends. And Kyle Heaton supposedly used the N-word with him, and that really pissed Craig off, and he kind of just stewed over it. But Kyle Heaton was interviewed later after this motivation came to light, and he said that he never used any racial epithets. The other kids that were with Craig said, yeah, Kyle Heaton did say something to us about being in the street and not getting hit by a car, but they don't remember any racial connotations to the statements that Kyle made. I think it's just some rationalization by a Ted Bundy-level maniac, really. And to be quite frank, guys, I think these were sexually motivated homicides. Because don't forget, he had been arrested or some type of charge for stalking as a juvenile. He'd look through people's windows and watch them. And I think, you know, age 13, 15, you're becoming aware sexually. And I think these were sexually based crimes. I don't think racism had much to do with it. I don't know how much racism Craig had suffered. You know, I don't want to downplay that, but the Heaton girls, age 7 and 10, they did nothing to you. And you stabbed them, I don't know, over 60 times between the two of them? I just don't buy it. He's just a killer, like Ted Bundy. And don't forget, guys, the majority of Craig's friends were white, right? Friends with the family. It was a whole neighborhood. The guy was just a bad machine, I think. So the uproar in Rhode Island and nationwide, really, against juvenile offenders, man, this went through the roof. Some local people started a nonprofit group to keep Craig Price in prison by any means necessary, really, because this guy was going to get out. He'd already slaughtered 4 people, right? Imagine if he gets out on his 18th birthday, 2 years, maybe he gets 2 years of counseling. And he's back out living next door to you. Are you kidding me? So through a series of legal maneuvers, they do keep Craig Price in prison. And thank God he's still in prison today. So at a certain point, Craig refused to be interviewed by psychiatrists. And the court ended up charging him with contempt of court because the court had ordered him to be examined and he refused. So they tack on some time there. He eventually gets transferred to Big Boy Jail in Rhode Island. And infraction after infraction keeps lengthening his sentence. And he's such a problem on the inside. Eventually, he gets transferred out of Rhode Island because he's such a problem to a prison in Rayford, Florida. And during that time frame, Craig Price was accused and later convicted of stabbing someone else. This is at least person number 5 he stabbed in his lifetime. April 4, 2017, he stabs Joshua Davis and was ultimately sentenced to 25 years on that charge. So this asshat is never getting out of prison. Thank God. Honestly, I think prayers were answered on this one because in 2009, Craig was due to be paroled in 2022. He'd already be out right now, but in 2017, he goes on to stab somebody in Florida with a 5-inch knife, shiv or whatever. So, man, God answered those prayers to keep this barbarian inside the walls, right? So the laws on juveniles had obviously been changed since Craig Price, and he was a catalyst for the change, more harsher penalties for juvenile murderers. That's now going the other way, where you can't give a juvenile a life sentence without parole. But come on. I mean, I still think Craig Price was so dangerous, even if that law was in effect when he committed his homicides in Rhode Island, they still would have held him. He's that much of a boogeyman. He is the boogeyman. He is the person you fear when you shut the lights off. When your kids make you check under the bed, that's the guy they're afraid of. I'd like to call Craig Price an animal, but that does a disservice to the animal community. Animals don't kill like Craig Price. He's purely human. So guys, I think we dodged a bullet on Mr. Price's release. Man, he's a bunch of crazy. He's never expressed any remorse. And he talks about the homicides in like a sing-song voice. He's not sad about it. I think he's sad he got caught. But to be quite frank, I think he enjoyed it. I can't believe it. I can't believe what this guy did, even at that age. All right, guys, like I said, I'll try to put the confession, I think it's up on YouTube. I'll put it in the show notes so you can take a look, but damn, take a deep breath. This is the guy you're afraid of. When you're going to buy a gun to protect your home, this is the guy you should envision. And I do recommend all of our female listeners to buy a firearm to keep at home. It is the ultimate equalizer. And against somebody of Craig Price's size, you need to equalize it. You dig? All right. That's what I got for you on this one. I'm on to the next one. If you need to get a hold of me, guys, it's Barry@BostonConfidential.net. That's definitely the best platform. Look forward to hearing from you. I'll see you on the flip side.